I told him, you know, I'm guilty of that charge, you know. I'm not gonna back away from what I said.
A Manicotic man confesses to killing an unarmed village public safety officer. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, March 20th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the City of Anchorage sues over the port expansion project.
When the suitability study was completed, we found out the full extent of the problems.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Leroy Dick Jr. is confessing to killing an unarmed village public safety officer in Manicotic. Dick allegedly shot VPSO Thomas Madole yesterday afternoon. Madole was a former pastor who leaves behind a wife, a son, and a daughter. Leroy Dick made his first court appearance today in Dillingham, telling the magistrate he killed Madole. KDLG's Dave Benninger reports.
According to the State of Alaska's version of yesterday's events, when VPSO Thomas Madole arrived, unarmed, at Dick's residence in Manicotic, he was there as a counselor and friend, as much as the only public safety officer on duty that day in the small community. The investigation hasn't produced many details yet, but it's clear VPSO Madole went to the house for a reason, at least a disturbance, possibly a threat of violence or suicide. At some point, VPSO Madole turned to leave the scene and was shot and killed by a rifle, allegedly by Leroy B. Dick Jr.
Leroy Dick Jr., 42 of Manicotic, was taken into custody a short time later, not far from the residence where VPSO Madole was located.
That's Colonel Keith Mallard, the director of the Alaska State Troopers. Dick was held in custody overnight and made a first felony appearance in Dillingham Wednesday morning. After having been told of the charge he was facing, which is first-degree murder, and of his rights to a speedy trial and an attorney, Dick at first refused legal counsel. The magistrate gave a lengthy description of why it would be in his interest to have an attorney, whereupon Dick said this.
You still want to proceed without a lawyer?
To be honest, you know, I could say I'm guilty of the crime.
Well, we're not here to take a plea today.
Dick later agreed to have an attorney appointed from the Public Defender's Agency and was remanded back to custody, held on $1 million bail. Dick agreed to speak with me about his actions at the jail in Dillingham Wednesday afternoon.
Well, it came out of frustration, you know, and I shouldn't have done that. I know it's wrong. So I made a big mistake out of it.
Why did that happen?
Well, you know, I didn't want to be bothered, and, you know, I got in an argument with my mom and my brother and his dad, and I was kind of feeling unhappy. So, you know, I tried to calm myself, and I end up, you know, doing something wrong to the VPSO. Guess I caused it to happen, you know. He just wanted to talk to me, and I told him not to bother me, and, you know, guess I went out angry and did what I did, you know.
Dick has been in Manicotic for most of his life and claims he had not had any other problems with the VPSO since Madole came to the area in 2011.
Yeah, he's always been good to me ever since he came up, you know, and, you know, he's been good to me and I've been good to him, and, you know, I feel bad what I just did to him, you know. I really do apologize to his family, and, you know, I didn't know he had family of his own. Yeah, I feel sorry for what I did, you know, I really want to apologize, but, you know, I can't fix what just happened, you know.
AST Director Colonel Mallard is confident the investigation has been handled well. VPSO Madole's body was transported to Anchorage earlier. The fallen village public safety officer has traveled and will remain under formal escort by uniformed officers until he's laid to rest.
He's a law enforcement officer, and just like any other law enforcement officer that pay the ultimate price, he will be treated with the same dignity and respect that anybody else would.
Reporting in Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
Governor Sean Parnell released a statement today expressing his sadness over the tragic death of Officer Madol. Parnell has ordered all state flags to be lowered tomorrow in honor and memory of Madol. He is the first VPSO to be killed in the line of duty since Ronald Zimmon was shot and killed in the Bristol Bay Borough in 1986. The Alaska House of Representatives today passed a Stand Your Ground bill on a 33-5 vote. House Bill 24 expands what's known as the Castle Doctrine, which allows people to use deadly force to protect their homes and businesses from intruders. The controversial legislation extends that protection to any place a person lawfully has a right to be. Bill sponsor, Big Lake Republican Representative Mark Newman, says it simply clarifies that self-defense is not a crime.
If you're in your home and an invader comes into your home, are you supposed to, you know, if we had a duty to retreat, maybe go hide in your bedroom? That's not what it says. It says you have the right to defend yourself in your home. Why shouldn't you carry those rights anywhere you have a right to be and make that clear?
Newman has introduced versions of the bill in previous legislatures, but they died in the Senate after passing the House. Similar laws are already on the books in about 24 states nationwide. They came under scrutiny last year after unarmed teenager Trayvon Martin was shot and killed by a neighborhood watch volunteer, George Zimmerman, in a suburban Florida community. Initially, Zimmerman was not charged for the shooting because of Florida's Stand Your Ground law. Opponents of House Bill 24 cite concerns over whether it would limit the ability of prosecutors to try gang shootings, particularly in Anchorage. Andy Josephson, a Democrat who represents the Anchorage University District, also brought up potential public safety concerns.
I'm worried about more bullets being shot and the innocent people in the background of the shooting scene, in a mall, for example, on a Christmas Eve day, who are just shopping. And I don't think we've covered thoroughly enough what the liability might be to them.
Josephson was one of four Democrats who voted against the bill. The only Republican to oppose it was Lindsey Holmes, a former Democrat who represents West Anchorage and switched parties just before the start of this year's session. The Alaska Department of Law has had concerns over the 2010 Stand Your Ground bill, with then Attorney General Dan Sullivan writing that it would encourage the needless taking of human life. Current Attorney General Michael Garrity reversed course last year and has said he supports the current version of the bill. HB 24 still needs to pass the Alaska Senate before it can go to Governor Sean Parnell for his signature. Debate on whether the state's oil tax system should be overhauled continued in fits and spurts throughout the day. By early evening, the Senate had considered 7 amendments to a bill flattening the tax rate on oil companies and shifting incentives for credits. So far, only one has passed. An amendment supported by 11 members of the majority would set the base tax rate on oil at 35%. An earlier version of the bill would have included an automatic 2% reduction to that amount after 3 years. According to state estimates, that would have cost the state an extra $300 million in lost revenue at forecasted levels of oil production. The Democratic minority offered most of the other amendments, with some aimed at bringing back progressivity and others narrowing the application of certain tax credits. But one of the more popular of the failed amendments actually came from Republican Gary Stevens. The Kodiak senator introduced a measure that would cause the tax changes to sunset after 3 years, if the legislature determined they weren't working. He said that as written, the bill risks giving industry too much of a tax break without a guarantee of increased production.
It is tying us into something that is enormously expensive for a very long time unless we have an escape clause.
The measure ultimately failed 11-9, but earned the support of the Senate Democrats and Sitka Republican Bert Stedman. The oil tax bill is one of Governor Sean Parnell's major priorities. Supporters say it's necessary to put more oil in the pipeline, while critics are concerned that it would bring down state revenue by roughly $1 billion each year without any commitments from oil companies to ramp up production. As of this evening, debate on the bill was ongoing, with more amendments expected. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the unusual and booming economy of the Matsu Valley.
In some way, the Matsu Valley kind of exports housing. I know that sounds strange, but exports housing to the rest of the state.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, committed to Alaska for nearly 60 years. From basketball games to sled dog races, Crowley supports events that bring Alaskans together. Crowley supports what matters, and public radio matters. CPDAlaska.com. And by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
Senator Lisa Murkowski is introducing her version of a revenue-sharing bill for both offshore and onshore energy production. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, it's the second bill this Congress, and it faces an uncertain future.
Under Senator Murkowski's plan, coastal states would receive 27.5% of revenue generated from offshore energy. In Alaska, a quarter of that sum would go to coastal boroughs, with the rest going into state coffers. Senator Murkowski says coastal states deserve the money brought in from federal waters.
We willingly want to access these resources. They provide good jobs and benefits, most certainly. But there is impact. There is undeniably impact.
From new infrastructure and traffic to oil spills, something neither she nor Senator Mary Landrieu mentioned when they unveiled their bill. Landrieu, a Democrat, represents oil-rich Louisiana. The plan creates revenue sharing of 50% for onshore renewable energy projects. Senator Murkowski says that puts renewables and fossil fuels on the same plane, because states now take home half of federal revenues for onshore oil, gas, and coal development. And the new bill would also allow states to pocket an extra 10% of the federal offshore revenue if they opt to use it to create conservation funds or invest in renewable energy. Senator Murkowski says that could raise a state's total take to 37.5%.
We want to do more to encourage the development, the research and development, the build-out of our clean energy sources. What better way to do that than to help pay for that from some of our offshore energy opportunities.
Just last week, President Obama proposed his plan to use money from offshore lease sales to encourage investment in alternative fuel cars and trucks. Including the money for conservation and renewable energy may win over some skeptical Democrats, but not all. 8 Democratic senators are circulating a letter opposing revenue sharing, saying any money generated from lease sales should go to paying down the debt, and oil spilled off the coast of one state could harm the neighboring ones. Senator Landrieu says Gulf Coast states have contributed $211 billion to the Treasury in oil and gas revenues, and that helps all states.
There are only 4 states producing that money. It's not Illinois, and it's, you know, not New Jersey. It's Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama.
That's a dig at Senators Dick Durbin, Bob Menendez, and Frank Lautenberg. They represent Illinois and New Jersey and signed the letter of opposition. Senator Durbin is the number 2 Democrat in the upper chamber. The bill does not call for any increased production, so overall, the federal government would earn less money if the bill became law. Congress will need to find cuts elsewhere to offset the loss of federal revenue. Both Senators Murkowski and Landrieu deferred any talk of cost to the Finance Committee, a committee neither serves on. Senator Mark Begich has introduced his own revenue-sharing bill, one that looks quite different from Senator Murkowski's. He says his plan would put more money into the local economies and native corporations and less into the state.
The key for me is going to be making sure our local communities, including tribes, are part of that question.
Senator Begich says he thinks the two plans can be reconciled. The plan would have to pass through the Senate Energy Committee before it can be considered by the whole Senate. There's no planned committee action just yet. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
A conservation group said today it will continue pushing federal authorities to more closely regulate muddy logging roads, despite a U.S. Supreme Court ruling that sided with the timber industry. Paul Kampmeyer, a lawyer representing Northwest Environmental Defense Center, said the ruling leaves room to try to get the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to take a tougher approach to pollution running off logging roads. The Supreme Court reversed a decision by the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals that EPA should regulate logging road runoff in the same way it regulates industrial pollution. A timber industry group says the current EPA policy regulating logging roads with the system used for farm fields is doing a good job. After years of problems which halted the Port of Anchorage project, the municipality of Anchorage is suing the designers. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan's administration filed the lawsuits in response to recent studies released by the engineering firm CH2M Hill. That company faulted the port's design. Robert Owens is an assistant municipal attorney with the city. He says the municipality has been investigating problems with the port since they arose in 2009.
When the suitability study was completed, we found out the full extent of the problems.
There were multiple problems with the project, which used a patented open-cell sheet pile design. Sheets of metal driven into the ground, shored up by metal supports with earth filled in behind, were supposed to create a base for the port, but some crumpled or separated during construction. Owen says besides the problems that came up during construction, the CH2M Hill report indicates the port structure might not hold up during an earthquake.
It was unstable. It could fall or tip or collapse or fail in some fashion because part of it, the native soils that it's sitting on, Bootlegger Cove clay, is unstable or could liquefy. It wasn't just the way it was built, but really more that it won't stand the test of time. It won't. There's real concerns about whether it would be stable over time.
The now-defunct Vico Corporation produced a stability study on the port, and Vico was then purchased by CH2M Hill. Now that company says its predecessor's study was bad. The municipality is suing three parties, Integrated Concepts and Research Corporation, or ICRC, CH2M Hill Alaska, and PND Engineers. Kenton Braun is the vice president of PND Engineers. He defends his company's design and says the problems arose because of incorrect installation.
The reason that we're all talking is because the construction went bad out there, and it was the methodology that led to the problems.
Braun says contractors to ICRC, the general contractor working for the Maritime Administration, which was managing the project for the city, are responsible.
We were tasked to design the facility, and what happened was it went wrong when it went to construction. It was an inexperienced contractor that got involved and failed to construct it properly.
Braun says contractors tried to drive the metal sheets into the earth by pounding them in at close range from the shore with a pile-driving hammer. He says the slope began to erode into the partially constructed wall, increasing pressure, making it difficult to drive the sheets in. He says they could have used a barge from the waterside, which is a method that had been proven successful. The port project was started back in 2003 under Mayor George Wirsch and Port Director Bill Sheffield. The design was approved in 2006 under Mayor Mark Begich. Sheffield was still the port director. The Sullivan administration has led the push to get the municipality reimbursed for its losses. The municipality has an ongoing relationship with the U.S. Maritime Administration to complete the project and is not suing them. Earlier this month, CH2M Hill released a second study and presented three new designs for the administration to consider. Attorneys say they will likely decide on a new design in the coming months. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
The Kinnickarm Crossing would connect Anchorage to the Matsu Valley. The bridge is intended to create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and save freight costs for Alaska's interior and North Slope. More information on the Kinnickarm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnickarm Bridge and Toll Authority.
On March 15th, volunteers with the Iditarod Trail Committee discovered a 5-year-old husky had been buried and asphyxiated by drifting snow in Unalakleet. Today, ITC released the results of an investigation into the death. KUAC's Emily Schwing reports.
The dog named Dorado had been dropped at the Unalakleet checkpoint on March 11th by rookie musher Paige Drobny of Fairbanks. But high winds and poor weather on March 14th grounded commercial airplanes and race personnel were unable to fly drop dogs back to Anchorage. More than 130 Iditarod race dogs were being cared for in Unalakleet. It's a regional hub along the Iditarod Trail. As the storm became more severe, volunteers moved just over 100 dogs inside. Due to lack of space, they relocated roughly 30 to what they call a more protected outdoor area. According to a press release, an Iditarod Trail Committee volunteer veterinarian checked on the dogs around 3 a.m. At 8:30 a.m., another round of checks took place. Eight dogs were found buried by drifted snow, including Drobny's dog Dorado, who was found deceased. Preliminary necropsy results indicate the dog died of asphyxiation. Further results will be available within the next 30 days. Mushers often drop dogs during the race to prevent injury, illness, and sometimes even as part of their race strategy. Drop dogs are left in the care of volunteer race veterinarians at checkpoints. Over the last week, race marshal Mark Nordman, head veterinarian Stort Nelson, as well as Paige Drobny and husband and fellow musher Cody Straith, and other Iditarod personnel have met for a series of discussions on how to improve care and handling of drop dogs. In its press release, the ITC lists a number of mitigation measures to ensure better dog care in the future. The race will build dog boxes to house dogs in both the McGrath and Unalakleet checkpoints. The organization will also arrange for more frequent flights out of checkpoints. Veterinarians will also patrol dog lots where drop dogs are staying more frequently. Race officials will continue to work with mushers and volunteers on dog care issues. In a post on her kennel's website, musher Paige Drobny called the ITC's announcement positive change. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
A Bethel man has pleaded guilty to fraudulently using the official letterhead for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The forgery was used in letters he mailed out to several local villages last spring. From Ember Station KYUK in Bethel, Sophie Ivan reports.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service quickly learned of the fraud. The Yukon Delta Wildlife Refuge, based in Bethel, found out that a number of villages had received a letter, and management knew immediately it wasn't from them. So they collected the fraudulent letters that were sent to the villages, and using the postmark and the postage stamp, investigators were able to trace it back to one man, 50-year-old John Owens of Bethel. Assistant U.S. Attorney Yvonne Lamore helped prosecute the case. She says Owens may have been motivated after reading an article about the Fish and Wildlife Service's enforcement priorities, which included planned enforcement of the lead shot ban and enforcement of the ban on hunting emperor geese and the stellar eider. In the letter, Owens changed the Fish and Wildlife's intentions and fabricated their consequences.
Are going to make sure that all hunters have hunting license and duck stamps, and that the Fish and Wildlife Service enforcement officers were going to confiscate any illegal catch of waterfowl, eggs, shotguns, and ammunition from all hunters, and will be cited and fined through the state courts according to set policies for hunting illegally in the Yukon Delta National Wildlife Refuge.
Lamore says Owen's letter damaged years of building relationships with the subsistence hunters.
It appears that Mr. Owens, based on a misunderstanding, drafted the letter, and then with the effort to get people angry or incite them or stir them up against the Fish and Wildlife Service.
The federal court fined Owens $500 and demanded he write a letter explaining his actions to be published in a regional newspaper. He also has been put on 1 year's probation. In Bethel, I'm Sophie Ivan.
The Matanuska-Susitna Borough's unique economy is affecting many other areas of the state. That's the word from a noted economist who outlined his findings before the Borough Assembly yesterday. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Economist Neil Fried is calling it a boom. Fried says the borough's growth is reflected in housing, in schools, almost every area, except, paradoxically, in employment. But Fried says local job growth is actually not a good indicator of the Mat-Su area's economy. Although about 1,000 retail, healthcare, and hospitality jobs were added over the past decade, the borough's jobs growth has been tied firmly to Anchorage. Fried says over 40% of workers living in Mat-Su earn their paychecks elsewhere.
Anchorage obviously is the biggest place where those earnings come from, but a big chunk comes from the North Slope borough.
He says the Mat-Su provides the second largest supply of labor to the North Slope after Anchorage. What does this mean to the state? Fried is not sure. He says the valley contributes to the state's broader growth, but one of the areas that Mat-Su differs from the rest of the state is in the jump in valley school enrollment.
It's been very rapid here, very different story than what's happening to elsewhere in the state. Same with population growth. You know, population's been growing much faster. So, you know, if you need new infrastructure, whether it's new roads or new schools, there's probably more demand for that in a place that's growing fast.
While school enrollment in other areas of the state peaked in 1999 and has since declined, Mat-Su schools grew 9% during the last 5 years. So building more schools and creating more infrastructure will cost the state, but Fried notes Mat-Su's affordable housing benefits the state on the whole.
In some way, the Mat-Su Valley kind of exports housing. I know that sounds strange, but exports housing to the rest of the state, because a lot of the people that live here don't work here. They work all over. They can live somewhere else. They don't necessarily have to live here, but they choose to live here. So in a sense, the Mat-Su Valley is providing that housing services to a significant slice of Alaska's population, whether they work on the slope, Anchorage, Red Dog, or you know, Bristol Bay or somewhere else.
The pattern of labor and housing exports from the Mat-Su has benefited Mat-Su's economy. Fried's research shows that more earnings flow into the Mat-Su than flow out, making it unlike any other part of the state.
It's very significant. You know, the last year I looked, 8% of the Valley residents work on the slope, but almost $220 million flow in here from payroll from the slope. And almost as much earnings comes from Anchorage to Valley residents than earnings from Valley residents earning their wages right here in the Valley.
Fried says these trends have not changed for quite a while and are expected to continue. He says population growth is the most important indicator of the area's economy. Between 2000 and 2012, Mat-Su population grew some 58% compared with Anchorage growth of 15% and the state's 17%. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. You can hear tonight's stories at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Casey Kelly in Juneau, Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Sophie Ivan in Bethel, and Ellen Lockyer in the Mat-Su Valley. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.